The British Interior Minister is in Rwanda to discuss a migration deal that has drawn widespread criticism over the rights of asylum seekers. Russia dismisses as meaningless the move by the International Criminal Court to issue an arrest warrant against President Putin. And Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan is set to appear in court following clashes between his supporters and security forces this week over an arrest warrant against him. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, British Interior Minister Suella Braverman is in Rwanda to discuss a controversial deal that sends migrants seeking asylum in the UK to the African nation. Braverman has said her trip aims to discuss plans to operationalize the deal shortly. London clinched the deal or the agreement that is with Kigali in April last year to send tens of thousands of migrants on a one-way trip to Rwanda. The plan hit a roadblock as the first deportation flight was cancelled by an injunction from the European Court of Human Rights. And in December, London's High Court ruled that the scheme was lawful. The plan has drawn widespread criticism for both in the UK and outside, including from the UN Refugee Agency. London says it wants to contain illegal migrants. Critics say the plan is inhumane. The International Criminal Court issues an arrest warrant for Russian President Vladimir Putin over alleged war crimes in the Ukraine war.
The International Criminal Court has issued two warrants of arrest in the Ukraine situation. For Vladimir Putin, President of the Russian Federation, and for Maria Lvova-Belova, Commissioner of the Russian President for Children's Rights, for the alleged war crimes of deportation of children from Ukrainian-occupied territories into the Russian Federation.
The ICC judge says the execution of the arrest warrant depends on international cooperation. The Hague-based court has no powers to arrest suspects. It can only exercise jurisdiction within the countries that are signed up to its agreement. Russia is not a signatory, and the Kremlin has dismissed the ICC claims as outrageous and null and void. The Russian Foreign Ministry also says the warrant lacks any meaning or legal value for Moscow. Russia had itself previously accused Ukraine of committing war crimes. It says Kiev has used Western-made weapons against hospitals and civilian infrastructure in the annexed regions of Ukraine. The Pentagon has released a video it says provides evidence that a Russian fighter jet caused a U.S. spy drone to crash into the Black Sea this week. The Pentagon says the video shows that the Russian fighter jet clipped the propeller of the American MQ-9 Reaper drone, causing its crash near Ukraine. The video was filmed by the drone, which the U.S. says was on a regular reconnaissance mission in international airspace. Russia denies that and sees the incident as a provocation. Moscow says the aircraft went down after making, quote, sharp maneuvers. It has warned of a proportionate response in case of future provocations. That's while the U.S. says it will continue to fly and operate wherever international law allows. The incident was the first direct encounter between the two powers since the Ukraine war began in February last year.
Tensions between the U.S. and Russia have risen to unprecedented levels after Washington accused Moscow of colliding with one of its Reaper surveillance drones, forcing it to crash into the Black Sea waters off Crimea. Russia denied it deliberately brought the unmanned aerial vehicle down. Moscow says the drone went down after stalling and never came into contact with another aircraft. Russia says the UAV was flying towards the Russian border without an active transponder, in clear violation of the restricted area established for the conduct of the special military operation. Two interceptors were dispatched to investigate. As a result of sharp maneuvers, the MQ-9 unmanned aerial vehicle went into uncontrolled flight, lost altitude, and collided with the water surface. The Russian fighters did not use weapons, did not come into contact with the UAV, and returned safely to their home base. That's what the Russian Defense Ministry stated. But the U.S. has rejected Russia's explanation, accusing Russian jets of an unsafe and unprofessional intercept of the drone. U.S. military officials claimed their spy drone was operating in international airspace when a pair of Su-27 jets appeared, sprayed it with fuel, and struck the propeller of the UAV, which caused it to crash into the sea.
But there is a pattern of behavior recently where there is a little bit more aggressive actions being conducted by the Russians. We haven't completed our analysis as to why that's happening. And it wasn't just involving us. There were some incidents earlier with the British and some other nations as well.
The U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has already reached out to his Russian counterpart, Sergei Shoigu, to discuss the incidents. The last time Shoigu and Austin spoke was in October 2022. The latest incident has further strained the already tense relations between the two nations.
I just got off the phone with my Russian counterpart, Minister Shoigu. As I've said repeatedly, it's important that great powers be models of transparency and communication. And the United States will continue to fly and to operate wherever international law allows. And it is incumbent upon Russia to operate its military aircraft in a safe and professional manner.
Well, Russia says its relations with the U.S. have reached a lamentable state. Hawkish U.S. politicians are now demanding action against Russia over the incident. Washington has said U.S. aircraft will fly wherever international law allows, warning Russia to operate with caution.
Kremlin said on Wednesday that relations with the U.S. were in a lamentable state and at their lowest level. Calls are already growing loud in the U.S. to retaliate against Russia. Hawkish Republican Senator Lindsey Graham has suggested opening fire on Russian fighter jets that intercept U.S. drones.
They shot down our drone. What should our answer be?
Well, we should hold them accountable and say that if you ever get near another U.S. set flying in international waters, your airplane would be shot down. What would Ronald Reagan do right now? He would start shooting Russian planes down if they were threatening our assets.
Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, said the senator's call to shoot down Russian aircraft went far beyond common sense and risked all-out war between the world's largest nuclear powers. Since Russia started the military operation in eastern Ukraine, contact between American and Russian military leaders has been limited. Meanwhile, Italy's foreign minister, Antonio Tajani, has said that the drone crash represents a moment of great tension in relations between Moscow and Washington. He also urged the West and Russia to exercise caution so that they could avoid a direct clash. The crisis comes as the war is still raging on in eastern Ukraine. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has said Russian forces must be stopped in Bakhmut and other towns in the east. Russia has said the capturing of Bakhmut opens a path to taking control of the entire Donetsk region, one of its central war aims.
Wagner PMC units have practically surrounded Bakhmut. Only one road is left open to Ukrainian forces. The pincers are getting tighter. If earlier the professional Ukrainian army fought with us, today we see more and more old people and children.
Russian forces and fighters from Wagner Group have captured Bakhmut's east, but have apparently failed to encircle the city. NATO also warned last week that Bakhmut could fall within a matter of days.
Turning elsewhere, anger is growing in France after President Emmanuel Macron overrode Parliament and imposed a controversial pension overhaul. In the capital, Paris, demonstrators blocked one of the key highways around the city. Police used tear gas batons and water cannons to disperse them. The interior minister says over 300 people have been arrested. This comes after the French government forced through its vastly unpopular pension reform plans without a vote in Parliament on Thursday. The bill will raise retirement age from 62 to 64 and also make it more difficult to claim full pensions. Meanwhile, the leader of one of the political opposition groups in France's National Assembly has decided to file a motion of no confidence against the government.
D'opposition.
This is about helping our country by voting against this unfair and ineffective pension reform. It is about preserving our trampled parliamentary democracy and social democracy. It is about respecting and listening to our fellow compatriots, 80% of whom want this motion passed. Finally, the vote on this motion will help us emerge from a deep political crisis.
The no confidence motion has so far garnered 91 signatures, or signatories, that is, from five opposition groups, which is nearly 200 votes short. The MPs who have put down their names have called on their colleagues to be responsible and back the statement. France has been plagued by paralyzing protests and sprawling strikes since the president announced his pension reform plans in January. Macron says he can only keep the system from collapsing by imposing the changes, but opponents say the overhaul is extremely unfair. An attorney for former US President Donald Trump has been ordered to testify before a grand jury probing Trump's handling of classified documents related to his time in office. The ruling issued by a federal judge requires Ivan Corcoran, that is, to provide additional testimony. That's because his communications with Trump may have been related to criminal conduct. And back in January, Corcoran declined to respond to investigators' questions, citing attorney-client privilege. Now, the latest ruling has removed the privilege, considering a crime fraud exception. The U.S. Justice Department is investigating Trump for keeping classified defense records at his Florida home. He has denied that, accusing the department of a witch hunt against him. Following the latest ruling, Trump's spokesperson said they will fight the Justice Department. Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan is set to appear before the High Court in the capital, Islamabad, later in the day. That's according to his lawyer in Lahore. Imran Khan is accused of unlawfully selling state gifts given to him by foreign dignitaries when he was Prime Minister in 2018 to 2022. He denies any wrongdoing and had repeatedly refused to attend hearings on the case, citing safety concerns. Khan decided to show up in the High Court on Saturday after it cancelled an arrest warrant against him. The warrant triggered clashes between security forces and Khan's supporters in his hometown Lahore earlier this week. The legal proceedings against Khan began after he was ousted from office in a parliamentary vote early last year. Since then, he has been holding protests across the country calling for early elections. The government has so far refused his demand. North Korea says hundreds of thousands of citizens have volunteered to join or re-enlist in the nation's military to fight against the United States. According to North Korea's state newspaper, 800,000 students and workers across the country expressed their will to counter the U.S. The report said the number of people willing to enlist is just for Friday. This comes after the country launched its largest ever intercontinental ballistic missile on Thursday. Pyongyang said the Hwasong-17 missile was launched to demonstrate what it called a tough response posture amid the ongoing military drills by the U.S. and South Korea. North Korea considers the exercises as acts of hostility and a rehearsal for an invasion of its territory. Staying in the region, where South Korea says it will fully implement a key military intelligence sharing pact with Japan. That comes 2 days after the two countries held a summit in Tokyo on Thursday to rebuild security and economies ties. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol told Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida that he wanted a complete normalization of their 2016 military agreement. The pact enables the two U.S. allies to share military secrets. Seoul had threatened to scrap the deal in 2019 as relations with Tokyo soared, or soured rather, partly over a trade dispute. The two are concerned about what they see as security challenges posed by North Korea and China. Pyongyang and Beijing have repeatedly denied posing any such challenge. Every year in March, since 2005, pro-Palestinian activists directed by the BDS movement hold activities and events against the Israeli apartheid policies. Our correspondent Ola El-Asi reports from the besieged Gaza Strip.
The Israel Apartheid Week has started in Gaza and in many cities around the world. This is aimed at mobilizing grassroots support for the BDS campaign to isolate apartheid Israel in the global community, replicating the resistance movement against the South African apartheid.
Killing machine of apartheid Israel.
The week started with a message of solidarity to the Palestinians of the Gaza Strip from Mandela Mandela, the grandson of the South African leader Nelson Mandela.
We feel your pain and suffering and stand in solidarity with you in the struggle against the injustice and brutality imposed by the apartheid Israeli regime. We salute our heroes and martyrs of Gaza and the ordinary men and women, youth and children, who daily face the brutal killing machine of apartheid Israel. You are not alone.
As part of its events, the BDS chose to screen a movie about horror experienced by a Palestinian young girl during the Nakba. The ethnic cleansing of Palestinians by Zionists in 1948.
Well, I think the way Israel reacted to Farha is very typical of Zionist propaganda. They wanted to suppress the Palestinian voice. They didn't want us to tell our own narrative. And I think the best way of confronting this campaign of hate and racism is by producing more cultural products.
Palestinian institutions play an important role in informing people of the history of Palestine through different mediums in order to build a generation that is capable of reclaiming its rights.
I think that the new generation is passionate about learning the truth and the history of the struggle, because during their entire life they have experienced both physical and structural violence perpetrated by the Israeli occupation. They want to know why they suffer, are not allowed to travel, and live in poverty. All this leads them to question the roots of all the problems.
The BDS movement has stressed the need to press ahead with the campaigns against the Israeli apartheid, especially because the regime has intensified its persecution to maintain a system of settler colonial oppression and domination over the Palestinian lives and land.
Recently, we witnessed a growing solidarity with the Palestinian people, especially when the new far-right fascist cabinet took office and Israeli massacre increased in the West Bank. We aspire to reach the international community, not only in the civil global community, to boycott, divest from and sanction Israel.
In Israel Apartheid Week, Palestinians reaffirmed their commitment to resisting occupation, exploitation, oppression and apartheid like any other people, by all means permitted under the international law and the UN General Assembly resolution, which includes armed struggle. Ola El-Asi, Gaza.
And that brings an end to world news for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن
by means of Quran
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد اینها چیزایی لازم است
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones
اما این کافی نیست
But it's not enough
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن دوری از قرآن از قرآن
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran Quran Quran
کتاب الله
Tourism. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, as a reminder, we briefly talked about Gilan province and delicious foods of the province and made you familiar with the recipe of Mirza Qasemi as a very famous and tasty food, not just in Gilan province, but across Iran. Today, we are going to continue with the foods of Gilan province. Hope you'll enjoy it. Researchers deem that food enjoys 15% of a tourist expenses, or $150 to $200 averagely. Researchers also maintain that the reason for the return of 86% of tourists to a place is the memorable food experience that they have had in that place. The cuisine of Gilan province in Iran often remains indelibly in the mind of every tourist, thanks to the unique ways of preparation of foods and also observing of Islamic principles in making halal food, which is prevalent all over Iran and other Islamic countries. Local foods in Gilan have important specifications which distinguish them from the foods of other places. One of these specifications is that most of the foods in this region have an herbal origin. Thus, a Gilani woman can make different foods with vegetables for 30 days without the need for meat. Some of these foods are known with the suffix tare, which means leek. But in Gilan, it means fresh garlic leaves. These foods include torshe tare, gazane tare, khanshe tare, shirin tare, kadu tare, holfe tare, eshkane tare, pilas tare, ترنگ زبانی تره and so on. As it was said, the common ingredient in these foods is that they include fresh garlic leaves. Another specification of Gilani cuisine is that there are many fast foods in it. These foods share the suffix bij. They include sirabij, havij bij, panir bij, khoska bij, and so on. An outstanding habit of people in Gilan province is that they use garlic in almost every food. This has been bequeathed to these people from their forefathers. In fact, their forefathers had realized through experience that garlic is a good remedy against humidity, which is a cause of rheumatism. This has been proved through research. Caspian white fish is one of the most delicious fish in northern Iran. This fish is caught in the Caspian Sea and the rivers of Gilan and Mazandaran provinces. Caspian white fish has a lot of bones, but the meat is very soft. To make this fish, there are different ways. Some people fry it in oil with salt and pepper, while others make the inside-filled kind with various items. Now, the fish kind. First of all, wash the fish and peel the skin off both sides. Then cut it in a way as you like. Roll the fillets in salt, pepper, and turmeric. Then put them in a dish and cover them with narrow slices of onion. Now add fresh lemon juice. After 30 minutes, wash the fish and dry them. Pour flour in a dish and add some saffron and salt to it and stir them. Roll the fish in the flour. Then put the frying pan on fire to get hot. Now pour oil or butter in it. Once the oil is hot, grate garlic cloves and pour them in the oil. Then chop some ginger like chips or grate it and fry it well in a pan. Finally, fry the fish with mild flame. No need to say that. You should fry one side and the other. Now you can garnish the fish and enjoy eating it. Now listen to the ingredients and recipe for inside-filled fish. You need a fish, walnuts, pomegranate paste, aromatic vegetables, onion, salt, black pepper, frying oil, garlic, marjoram, and fresh lemon. And now the recipe. Wash and clean the fish well. Put some salt, black pepper, and fresh lemon to the fish and leave it for half an hour. Grate the onion and pour some oil in the frying pan. Once the oil is hot, add the onion and saute it for a few minutes. Then add the vegetables and stir the items to fry a bit. Grate the garlic cloves in small size and add them to the vegetables and onion. Put a bit of salt, pepper, and turmeric and saute them all. In the second phase, mince the walnuts in a mixture and add them to the former mixture. Add half a glass of pomegranate paste and a little marjoram and stir them well. Now, fill the mixture inside the fish. You can either stitch the fish with a sterile string and needle or use a few toothpicks. Then put the fish in the frying pan or the oven to cook. You can garnish the fish with fresh lemon or vegetables. It is usually served with rice and olive. Dear listeners, women in Gilan make another delicious food with the Caspian whitefish called gerdbij. To make this food, first clean and wash the fish well. Then cut open the stomach and sprinkle salt and pepper. Tie the head and the tail with a string so that the fish looks round. Mince a few cloves of garlic and soak them with onion and aromatic vegetables. Grind the walnuts and add them to the vegetables with bitter orange paste. Once these items are ready, fill the fish with caviar or other things. Now put a few clean pebbles in a dish called gemej and put the fish on the pebbles. Then pour 2 spoonfuls of water on the pebbles and let the fish cook with mild flame. Dear friends, gemej is a local pottery dish which the people in Gilan put it directly on fire to cook food.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Iran, Russia, and China are holding a joint maritime exercise in the northern part of the Sea of Oman. The naval drills are aimed at enhancing preparations to ensure maritime security in the region. These exercises come as Iran is expanding its relations with countries of the region in line with the Islamic Republic's good neighbor policy. Iran has always called for constructive cooperation among the regional nations to establish its stability without interference from the West. Now, with other nations like China playing as mediator, we witness an end to the U.S. meddling in West Asia, which has been marred with wars and conflicts. Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have Esha Krishnaswamy, podcaster and journalist, joining us from St. Petersburg. And journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, joining us from Brussels.
This is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to a Spotlight to both of our guests. Let's start off with Ms. Krishnaswamy in St. Petersburg. What is the importance of the drills, especially with the continued U.S. military presence in the region?
Well, the most important thing is to understand that the U.S. does more than conduct military drills in the Gulf of Oman. For example, in November 2021, they literally seized an Iranian tanker full of oil and just literally stole Iran's oil. So this is not only a message to the U.S. saying that the way the world used to be in the past 50, 60 years can no longer be sustainable is the first one. And second one, there's an actual national security concern for Iran, China, and Russia. The U.S. has made it no secret that they want to have a war with China over Taiwan. And just last week, NATO was doing military drills where they fake bombed, where they played a scenario where they bombed St. Petersburg. So it is definitely a way to make sure that these alliances are strong in case things get worse and more progressively aggressive on the part of the U.S.
Sure. Elijah Magnier, over to you now. What kind of message does this trilateral military maneuver send in your perspective?
Well, first of all, there are common factors in between the three countries. They are all three under the U.S. sanctions. All three reject the U.S. hegemony. All three don't want to war with the U.S., but don't want the U.S. to meddle in the Asian affairs and want the U.S. to limit its presence away from their country, away from their interests. And they're saying, well, in case of war, we can be ready and we need to collaborate and cooperate and then carry out maneuver. That this is not the first time. For Iran is the second time, but for Russia and China, this is the fourth time. And with the continuous U.S. threat against China in Taiwan and around China, establishing new bases in the Philippines, this is raising the alarms in China. And because China and Russia have a very close relationship and they have a collaboration on the strategic and military level, and also Iran with the Russian and the Chinese is developing its relationship, turning toward Asia. All that is sending a message that the world can work and can function much better away from the U.S. hegemony. However, if the U.S. wants to interfere in these countries' affairs, they are ready for peace, but also for confrontation.
Back to our guests in St. Petersburg. The Iranian Navy chief, he spoke of these drills. He said, quote, presently the unjustifiable presence of some foreign military forces continues to pose challenges to the region. The issue had to be addressed and handled. What unjustifiable presence is he alluding to?
Definitely the U.S. presence in the Strait of Hormuz along the Persian or Arabian Gulf, depending on your point of view. And the U.S. is very aggressive there. Like I mentioned earlier, they routinely seize Iranian oil tankers, and that is taking away actual revenue from Iran that can be used as hard currency. So, and also the U.S. bases in almost every so many Middle Eastern countries, and the illegal occupation of one quarter of Syria, where they're taking at least 25% of all Syria's wheat and also Syria's oil. So all of these are definitely unjustifiable. And if you look at a map, the U.S. is thousands of miles away, and there is no reason to be there other than to protect their business interests, which, again, is not as justifiable because for Iran, it is a matter of national sovereignty.
Elijah Magnier, what does a stronger bond, is something you just mentioned, but I want to elaborate, I want you to elaborate for us, please. What does a stronger bond between these three nations mean for the security of the region, most notably amidst the so-called maximum pressure campaign that the U.S. has been pursuing against Tehran?
Well, first of all, Tehran, as Russia and China, understand that it is dealing with the Atlantic Western alliance that are getting together, and they are not limiting their activity to the area where they are operating, or to the North Atlantic, or to the Middle East, but also moving toward Asia. And the double standard, when we hear the Americans saying to China, Taiwan is part of China, and we believe and recognize this is one China, and then they supply the Taiwanese with $1.4 billion worth of weapons, and then they provoke China. Inevitably, the provocation are already ongoing against Russia and has been ongoing for the last 43 years against Iran. So all three countries are very familiar with the U.S. provocation. And for Iran, it's important to rely on strategic allies that understand the real politics, understand very well where the West is coming from, what is the objective of the U.S. to protect its hegemony, to increase its presence, to force its allies to have nuclear submarines, only to cause a threat against China when China is not threatening its neighbors. And we've seen how the Americans wanted to occupy seven countries in 5 years, and including Iran, but they failed in Afghanistan, they failed in Iraq, and they failed in Syria. So Iran has all the right to be concerned about the U.S. Intentions, particularly with the riots that was hitting the country in the last month, and the declaration of the U.S. officials that they want to free Iran. All these indications, including the sanctions, the non-return to the JCPOA, are proof the West is providing to Iran that they have a very strong bad intention toward Iran, and they are trying to submit Iran, but it's too late, because now with the war in Russia, we understand that there is a very serious challenge to the U.S. hegemony, and it is happening.
Ms. Krishnaswamy, let's look at this issue from a different perspective. It's the second time the Islamic Republic has held a joint maneuver with two major world naval powers at this scale. When you look at the scope of these drills, what does this say about the military capability of Iran, which is almost all indigenously built?
It says that Iran is a very strong player in the military because they built their own weapons, and they're not reliant upon the West or anyone to buy their weapons. And it means that they are ready to fight if the need be. And of course, Iran has made like aerial vehicles, but for a while, its slightly weak point has been through the in the naval area. And it looks like they are ramping up so that they're ready in case the West decides to attack on all fronts. And definitely because the Strait of Hormuz is such a pressure point, the West will be looking very closely at it. And I'm sure they will be trying more provocations around the Strait of Hormuz.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
And Elijah Magnier, are the drills an indication of Iran's success in multilateral military cooperation despite U.S. attempts to isolate the country? Is that maybe one of the messages that Iran cannot be isolated?
Well, yes, indeed. We have seen Iran with its advisors working closely with the Russian army in Syria, and we have seen there is a military collaboration, exchange of expertise and skills from the Iranian part toward Russia that China can also benefit from, because Iran has been subject to many wars, many attacks. And for Russia, this is the first time since the Second World War that is facing such a big war. This is for the Russian scale. The Chinese are observing all the lessons from the war. This is why of Iran, with two very strong superpower like Russia and China, very a prestigious level for Iran, recognizing the position of Iran. And that means that Iran has a lot to offer to these two countries, and that these two countries take Iran extremely seriously. And I think that is the positive side, in a way, of the sanction that forced Iran to be more independent and rely on its skills and the knowledge of its own population and its own scientists to be able and have to the U.S. at the border of Iran and prevent the U.S. and Israel from having hostile intentions toward the country.
Ms. Krishnaswamy, can these maneuvers set a precedent maybe for other countries to forge closer ties and closer bonds in response to the U.S.'s isolationist policies?
Yes, as long as the country itself is independent. So often the way the U.S. works is that it goes and installs U.S.-friendly governments like they did in Myanmar. Now they're trying in Georgia again. And so as long as there's an independent government that wants to assert their national sovereignty, it can set a very good precedence, and perhaps it can, in the future, there can be some kind of mutual defense treaty as an opposition to NATO, which we know it doesn't only stay in the North Atlantic. They've attacked Afghanistan and Syria. So I think it is definitely, and it'll also give a lot of countries who are afraid that the U.S. will try aggressive moves a little bit more confidence to go ahead and oppose the U.S. So I absolutely think it can set a good precedent for many of the countries in both the Middle East and Asia.
And Elijah Magnier, having in mind the recent rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia that was mediated by China, will Beijing's links, in your opinion, with nations in the region begin to enhance on the aftermath of this?
Well, this is the first time we see a role for China that is involved in a very complex and complicated and difficult Middle Eastern reconciliation, particularly between two strong countries and adversary like Iran and Saudi Arabia. And with the success of China, that offer a very worrisome indications to the West that the role of the West has always been destructive and never managed to reconcile in the Middle East and in West Asia, while the role of China has been extremely successful. And China, I think, played a very efficient role by creating a kind of a platform where both countries could stand on and feel, well, everybody is winning and nobody's losing, and is offering guarantee. And by offering these guarantees, and for Iran and Saudi Arabia to believe in the Chinese guarantee, that already a huge step even for China to take so much credibility. And I think this is going to open the road for other countries, but it depends on how high is the Chinese appetite to continue with this mediation, because the prosperity of the Middle East and the countries in West Asia is very important for China as well. We have the Silk Road, there is a collaboration between the two major countries who are very oil-rich producers, and the Chinese need this energy that it doesn't have, and Iran and Saudi Arabia can produce and can export to China. So that will support the Chinese industry, will support the Chinese initiative to have more courage toward other initiative and bring more countries together.
Same question to you, Ms. Krishnaswamy. Give us your thoughts about the role that China can play in the Middle East in the wake of the rapprochement that it mediated and the reconciliation that it mediated between Tehran and Riyadh.
Well, just today I read that China just concluded its first big project with Saudi Arabia, where they gave a big yuan loan. So the first thing I can see is that they will be expanding the potential for the Belt and Road Initiative projects. And this will do a lot to remove the dependence on Western hegemony for construction projects that are often not very well done, if they're done at all. And it'll also remove the need for the institutions such as the IMF and the World Bank. So this will strengthen the ability of countries to decide their own fate, because they are not under the same kind of Western pressure as if they were like using the IMF or the World Bank for their development projects. I also think that China is ready to expand the Belt and Road Initiative beyond the original plan. So it makes sense, because when Asia is the biggest continent, and it makes sense that most commerce should be located here, and these projects will only make it easier in order to transmit goods and services. And of course, in order to do that, China definitely needs more and more energy. And having a peaceful relationship with both Iran and Saudi Arabia will definitely ensure that China will get its energy needs met in the future.
Mr. Magnier, Iran has boasted its quote-unquote look to the East foreign policy strategy. Could that also be setting a precedent for other countries in the region to look more towards establishing stronger relations with the likes of China and Russia as potential major global shifts are on the horizon?
The reason why countries in West Asia are not fully directed toward Asia and toward the East rather than the West, because they are afraid of the U.S. sanctions, and the U.S. Proved to be the bully of the world. We've seen during Donald Trump, his behavior and how he was threatening many countries, and Joe Biden is doing exactly the same, particularly with this war between the Americans and the Russians on the Ukrainian soil. So the reason why we see Iran turning toward Asia is that was part of the program of President Ibrahim Raisi from day one, because of his experience with the West, because the West proved to be unreliable even in internationally recognized agreement like the JCPOA. And we have seen how the European, that are the U.S. allies, did not honor their part of the JCPOA and did not abide by the nuclear deal. Therefore, they proved to be unreliable partners. This is why the Iranian turned toward Asia, and the world is watching. It's watching how Iran is not crippled under the U.S. and EU sanctions. Iran is surviving, has been surviving for the last 43 years, and is doing extremely well by creating further partnership with the Asian countries. Not only is also using the local currency, the Chinese and the yuan and the ruble, and this is what Saudi Arabia has followed suit. This is the first time we see Saudi Arabia exchanging energy, part of its percentage of its energy, in the Chinese and the Russian currency rather than 100% in the dollar. That's a huge step by watching Saudi Arabia also following Iran's step by turning toward China and Russia, maintaining excellent relationship without necessarily cutting the relationship with the West, because even Iran is not saying, I want to cut my relationship with the West, but the West is just not behaving in a respectful way with in relation to the international laws with Iran. So by Saudi Arabia having this kind of rapprochement with Iran and with going to China as a partner for the peace and dealing with the Chinese and the Russian, notwithstanding the U.S. anger and unease with the behavior of Saudi Arabia, that's a huge step that Iran has moved and has shown to the other countries in the Middle East that it's possible to do that, and it is possible to do business, and it's possible to do it with countries that respect their deals, and they are superpower like China and Russia.
Ms. Krishnaswamy, talking about the U.S.'s response here, the U.S. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby said that the drills were being monitored. Now, it's no secret that the U.S. and some of its allies in the past, they sought to create a military coalition against Iran in the region, having in mind Washington's heightened tensions with Moscow and Beijing as well. These joint drills are likely to be perceived as provocative by Washington, won't they?
Of course, but we have to kind of remember what Washington considers provocative is not really something a threat that is a threat to their national security, but something that endangers their position in the world stage. So once you account for what they're considering provocative, you will understand that it has nothing to do with U.S. national security. And I've read countless articles on CNN and every Western press. Like, it's always like something like Iran is provocative because they have ships in the Persian Gulf. So it's always, from the West point of view, it's always not, it's not a national security issue, but a threat to their hegemony. And of course, as more and more countries decide to oppose Western hegemony, they're going to get weaker. And at that point, they're probably going to get more hair triggered with their reactions and see more things as provocations, as opposed to other countries simply deciding to assert their national sovereignty.
All right, and very briefly, if you may, Mr. Magni, address the issue. We're going to have to wrap up the show pretty soon.
I think the seas is not under the U.S. Hegemony, is not U.S. control. The U.S. dominance is over. Today, there are serious challenges to the U.S., China and Russia, Iran, other countries in Latin America. India is stepping up. There are many countries, more than 70% of the world population, who disagree with the U.S. This never happened before. Today, we see a big split. We see more awareness among the population who understand the game of the U.S. and can watch the U.S., how it's falling from its empire, because no empire manages to stay for very long.
All right. Thanks a lot, podcaster and journalist Esha Krishnaswamy, joining us from St. Petersburg, and journalist and political analyst Elijah Magni joining us from Brussels. Thanks for contributing to the program, and a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sador Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.